that was in here was on business succession planning. And it reminded me of a guy I knew whose name was Dan. He was a single guy, and he was living or working for his dad, who had a very, very successful small business. Well, he found out that his dad was very, very sick and was going to die soon, and that he was about to inherit a large fortune. And so he decided that he needed a wife to share this future with. So one evening, he got dressed up in his nicest suit, and he went out to the nicest restaurant he could find. And there at the bar, he saw a beautiful, beautiful woman. And so he went up to her, and he said, "You know, I may just look like an ordinary man, but soon my father will die, and I will inherit $20 million. Well, the woman was very impressed, and she took his business card, and 3 days later, she became his stepmother. Now, the point of that story is twofold. One is that women tend to be better at estate planning than men. But two is you have to be very careful for unintended consequences. We may think we have things well in place and well in line, and come to find out that that's not the case. As we go through here, I'm going to, first of all, you'll notice circular 230. What this says is to completely disregard everything I say for the next hour and that you can't rely on any of it. So you got to love 230. And then here's the eye test. As Mark mentioned, I'm a graduate of the University of Utah. The football team is now 4-1 after beating Northern Colorado and then BYU 3 times. And so for those of you who stayed up to watch that, we are going to talk today about asset protection. And why are we going to talk about asset protection? For those of you who don't know, there's a daily service that's sent out. Mostly our litigators look at this service, but it's a summary of every single lawsuit that's filed in the state. If that doesn't make you want to do asset protection, I don't know what will. But I just like to scan it and look it over just to kind of see what's going on. And about a month ago, I ran across this case, and it's Keller v. Arabica LLC, DBA Beans and Brew Coffee House. And here's what it says. It's product liability and negligence. It says, defendant served a coffee that was too large and too hot with an unsecured lid, and the drink spilled in the plaintiff's lap while he was driving. He suffered second-degree burns to his genitals, thighs, and behind, and a, quote, uncomfortable fungal infection. Now, I know lawyers tend to be a little wordy, but it seems to me that the phrase uncomfortable fungal infection is a little redundant. You know, I don't know that I've actually ever heard of a comfortable fungal infection. But it does show you that you can never be too careful. It reminds me of the attorney who was talking with his client, and he said, "Do you think justice will prevail?" And the attorney responded, "Well, it's possible, but if so, we can always appeal." You just never know what's going to happen when we're talking about courts, about litigation, and in the world we live in. And so I think it's very important to talk through asset protection. But first of all, before we start getting into how to protect assets, let's first talk about what is asset protection. Well, there's two big keys, and if you don't walk away with anything else, this is what you need to walk away from this seminar. And I'll try to get this in before the sugar rush is done. You're still high on your ice cream. The first is you need to implement any kind of plan before there's a problem. Okay? I get a lot of clients who come in scrambling when there's already a problem, and oftentimes it's too late to do really effective planning. And the second is it needs to survive the light of day. Okay? I want to be able to have any kind of plan and be able to show the whole plan to anyone who sees it and have it still be effective. You know, a lot of clients think asset protection planning involves burying gold in the backyard or hiding money offshore, or things like that. The reality is the best asset protection plan is one that is clear, is understandable, and it can still be upheld as valid. So what do we do? One, all we're trying to do is place or reach assets outside of potential future creditors. We want to have full disclosure in what we're doing. We want to strategically own assets, and we want to compartmentalize risk. And that's a big tool, and I'll talk about how we actually do that and how we can do that. Let's talk about what it's not. Asset protection is not about hiding assets or misrepresenting the truth of the matter. The best plan is one that could be fully disclosed and still be effective. And that's what we're talking about. And anytime we talk about asset protection, we need to realize that we all do asset protection to a certain degree or another. I have some people who say, well, I don't believe in asset protection. And I say, really? I said, what kind of business do you have? Well, I have a corporation. Well, a corporation is an asset protection tool. It's designed to limit your liability. If you own stock, if I were to say, I would like to sell you some stock in IBM, but IBM may go bankrupt and you may lose your investment. And you say, okay, well, that's a risk I'm willing to take. But what if I said, okay, I want you to buy this stock in IBM and realize that if IBM goes bankrupt, you may be liable for your share of the debts and obligations of IBM. You might have to pony up money to cover their debts. You say, there's no way I would invest, or there's no way I would buy that stock. Well, it's an asset protection tool. It limits the potential that you have for loss. And so asset protection is very common in all different shapes and sizes in our economy. And really, to a large extent, it's what allows entrepreneurs to be entrepreneurial, is to realize that they can, to a certain extent, limit the risk or exposure that they have. Okay, for any estate or any asset protection plan to be effective, you need to overcome the biggest obstacle, and that is fraudulent conveyances. The traditional definition, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but the traditional definition of a fraudulent conveyance is any transfer which is intended to delay, hinder, or defraud creditors. And it has to be a transfer for less than full and valuable consideration. So if I transfer my house to my brother for $1 million and I just give it to him, and if it can be shown that the reason I gave that to him was to delay, hinder, or defraud creditors, that's a fraudulent conveyance that can be unwound and the house can be brought back to me and subject to the claims of my creditors. But if I sell my house, it's worth $1 million to my brother, and he gives me $1 million back, there's no fraudulent conveyance because I received full and valuable consideration for that transfer, fair transfer for it. So anytime you look at this, you have to look at what a fraudulent conveyance is. Now, the courts have also looked at other standards and other factors in determining whether something's a fraudulent conveyance. The second is whether the transfer you made left you insolvent. In other words, did you transfer so much of your assets that you have either little to no assets or actually a negative net worth after the transfer? That can be unwound even if you weren't intending to defraud creditors at the time. If you simply make a transfer that leaves you insolvent, any good asset protection plan needs to leave you with sufficient assets. And a creditor doesn't have to be someone who has a judgment. It can just be somebody that you owe money to. Okay, so it doesn't have to actually go through the full process of having a judgment for a fraudulent conveyance statute to come into play. Now, I mentioned that this does vary from state to state. Each state defines what a fraudulent conveyance is. In Alaska, for example, they dropped both hinder and delay from their definition. So they say a fraudulent conveyance is only one which is intended to defraud a creditor. Hindering and delaying aren't in that statute. And it has to do, you have to prove that you intended to defraud that creditor. In other words, in Utah, if I can show that a transfer was intended to delay or hinder creditor A, and I'm creditor B, and that transfer didn't affect me, I can still unwind that transaction. In Alaska, I have to actually show that it defrauded me as the creditor to me. If I knew about the transfer, then I'm out of luck in Alaska. So you have to look at each state. Each state has a little bit different definition of what a fraudulent conveyance is. So what does a fraudulent conveyance look like? Well, fraudulent conveyances have what the courts refer to as certain badges of fraud, or if it just looks bad or smells bad, it probably is bad. And so the first thing they look at is if you had a transaction with an insider. In other words, if I were, again, to sell my house to a third party, there's a presumption there that I sold it for fair value. Why? Well, because it's presumed that I would want to sell it for as much as I could, that the third party wants to buy it for as little as they have to, and so we get to fair market value. That's what the definition is, willing buyer, willing seller. Well, if it's a transaction with an insider, a father transferring assets to a child, that doesn't necessarily come into play. There may be other reasons that they would make that transfer and that they may be willing to make a transfer for less than fair value. So you, any kind of time you have a transaction with an insider, it is looked at with far more scrutiny than a transaction with a third party. If you retain possession and control, we see a lot of people who say, well, I don't own this house, I don't own this car, but I still use it, I still drive it, it's still mine. I gave away that piece of art to the museum, but yes, it's still hanging in my house. Those kind of things are indicators that potentially you didn't actually transfer the asset, that it's still yours. If you don't disclose or try to conceal it, or if you make a transfer within a short period of time before or after that there's a lawsuit. You know, if a doctor comes in and he said, look, I just botched a surgery, I just did a surgery on the left knee and I was supposed to do the right elbow and I got confused, that might be a little too late to do some good planning. Again, if the debtor takes off or if there was consideration that was less than for full and valuable consideration, or the timing of it, if it looks suspicious. Again, all of these are potential badges of a fraudulent conveyance. And again, in a fraudulent conveyance, you can the courts can simply just unwind what you did. Just put the parties back where they were before the transfer. As I mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of people have questions, is asset protection ethical? Is asset protection legal? And again, there's all different types of asset protection that we all do. Insurance is another form of asset protection, and we're going to talk about that. Having good not only property and casualty insurance, but umbrella insurance is a way to try to protect your assets. LLCs are another common example of asset protection. So it is something that people do to varying degrees, and in fact, there's statutory asset protection that we're going to talk about here in just a little bit. So how can you, a couple other things about asset protection, and then we'll get into an example. But really, one common method of asset protection is to convert or take unprotected assets and to make those protected assets. For example, if I have cash in my business or in my own personal account at the end of the year, that's a highly attractive, hard to protect asset. If I put it into an IRA or a 401k, I put it into life insurance, certain things like that, I've suddenly moved it from an unprotected asset to a protected asset. I've changed the status of that and changed the protections afforded to it. Homestead allowances and also vary from state to state. It's really interesting. In Utah, our homestead allowance is $40,000. What that means is if I file bankruptcy, I can protect up to $40,000 of equity in my house. Anything beyond that is subject to claims of creditors. In Florida, it's unlimited. I can own a $3 million home free and clear. If I file bankruptcy, that's not subject to creditor claims. If you remember, O.J. Simpson was found not guilty in his criminal trial on the deaths of his wife and boyfriend, but his ex-wife and boyfriend, but he was found civilly liable for their deaths because it's a lower burden of proof, and they got a large judgment against him, a multi-million dollar judgment. Well, O.J. proceeded to move to Florida, one, because he thought that the golf courses of Florida would be the best place to look for the killers. But the second reason is that he could buy a multi-million dollar home there free and clear, and he waits out the statutory waiting period, and he could file bankruptcy, not be subject to that judgment, and creditors couldn't come after that house. If you guys remember the Enron bankruptcies, a lot of those the key guys in Enron were able to file bankruptcy with multi-million dollar homes in Texas. Texas also has an unlimited homestead allowance. And so even though the bankruptcy code is federal, the federal courts rely on each state in certain exemptions and certain definitions they have. And so bankruptcy law can vary from state to state. Homestead allowance is one of the huge ones. Also, asset protection is very fact sensitive. It's interesting, there's one case here where a debtor received a $100,000 check, or he took $100,000 and paid it towards his mortgage. And again, because it's Florida, it had unlimited homestead allowance. And the court ruled that it was perfectly fine, permissible. He could take that money and pay down his house without a problem. But in a very similar case, the court said that, hey, you paid down your mortgage 2 weeks before you went bankrupt. That was a fraudulent conveyance, because the only reason you did that was to defraud creditors. And so you could have two very similar fact patterns go in two different directions. And obviously, my guess is there were a number of different nuances in these cases, but it shows you that asset protection planning is very fact sensitive, and you need to look at each individual fact circumstance separately. So probably the easiest thing to do would be to just go through a fairly common example. We'll take a doctor, an OB, obviously low risk, and let me just show you what assets he has. He has a house, he also has a cabin, he has some cars, all those he holds jointly and joint tenancy with his spouse. He's got a boat. He figured he needed a little more risk in his life, so he got a boat. He's got an IRA, 401k, he owns some life insurance. He owns it. His kids and wife are the beneficiaries. He bought a house for his mom that she lives in. He's got some brokerage accounts, some checking and savings, and then he decided he wanted to own some rental properties. So he's got some rental properties too. You know, this obviously he's got a lot of moving parts here, but this isn't a too out of the common, out of the blue example here. So let's talk through this. When you look at asset protection, there's really a kind of a sliding scale. On the one hand, let's say I have 100% of my assets all in cash in my name. That'd be kind of one on the scale of 1 to 10 when it comes to asset protection. On the absolute opposite end, I have absolutely no assets in my name at all. So as we look at this, we're just going to talk about how do we move along this continuum from basically no asset protection at all, and what things can we do to add a little bit more protection to what we're doing here. And at the end of the day, I only want to complicate a client's life as much as I have to accomplish what I want to. It doesn't mean I don't want to complicate a client's life, but we only want to have complication and additional work that whose benefits outweigh the burdens. And so let's talk through these kind of things. And again, anytime we look at asset protection, it's important to look at it from the potential creditor standpoint. And creditors always look at two things. The first is, what are my chances of prevailing on the merits? If I think I've been wronged by somebody, they've injured me, a breach of contract, whatever it is, what are my chances that I'm going to win this case? But then the second question is, okay, even if I win, what are my chances of prevailing on the merits of the case? That's always something that you look at. If I'm walking down the sidewalk and I get run over by a bicyclist, am I going to sue? Well, if it's a homeless guy, I'm probably not going to sue him. If it's John Huntsman, I might think about suing. Well, what happened to me didn't change, but who did it to me did change, and it affects how people react. I mean, I tell a lot of clients, especially doctors, I said, you've got two risks. One is obviously inside your profession, but two is you have that DR before your name. And unfortunately, if you're involved in an auto accident, someone slips and falls on your front porch, any of those kind of things, you could be subject to a higher level of risk because of what you do as much as what you did. And so you need to look at those kind of factors and realize that certain people, either because of their net worth or because of their professions, are higher risk targets. Okay, so even if you do nothing, there are still some statutory protections, protections under Utah law that are afforded to every person. First of all, qualified retirement plans, 401ks, are protected under the 2005 Bankruptcy Act. You can protect up to $1 million inside of a 401k, and that is not subject to creditor claims, even in a bankruptcy. And that's why I always warn clients, if they get into dangerous financial circumstances, one of the things they want to do is they want to pull money out of their retirement plans. And there's a double whammy to that. First of all, you're going to probably pay 40 cents on the dollar or more in taxes. But two, you're converting assets that are otherwise protected, and you're making them now completely subject and exposed to creditor claims. And so you need to be very careful when you take those kind of assets out. Utah has further protected IRAs, and IRAs are afforded the same protection. So you can protect up to $1 million inside retirement plans. Yes? Yes. Yeah, good question. Good question. Family annuities. There's actually, you can also protect annuities under Utah law if their assets held and the proceeds paid to the extent reasonably necessary for the support of beneficiaries and dependents. So if you have annuity that's being used and relied on by people, that can be protected, as well as life insurance is another great asset protected vehicle. Everything can be protected except for the last 12 months of insurance premium payments. They don't want you to have a circumstance or situation that arises and try to cram a whole bunch of money into a life insurance policy and then have it protected. But if you've been putting money away in a life insurance policy for a significant period of time, not only can the cash value, but the death benefits be protected from potential creditor claims. Yes?
What about in the annuity? Can they put money in an annuity that's intended to support their family within the last 12 months, or would that be
Yeah, good question. Again, it's a facts and circumstances, but if you can show that the money is in there, what you may have to do is annuitize it because and not turn it into a lump sum, but rather an income stream. Yeah. Another common protection is to place assets in the name of a spouse. As a general rule under Utah law, a spouse is not liable for the debts and obligations of the other spouse. Yes. Yeah, and we'll talk about the IRS in just a second. But as a general rule, the only thing that you can't discharge from the IRS are the last 3 years tax returns, assuming you always file timely.
If it's not income,
yeah, if it's employment or fiduciary taxes, it's a different deal. Yeah, I had a client come in and he said, you know, I said my wife passed away and I had a business and I was doing a couple other things and I haven't filed my taxes for a little while and I need to get going on that. And I said, okay, well, that's understandable. You know, life happens. I said, you know, when was the last time you filed a tax return? And he said, well, I think it was about 19 years ago. You know, and I'm the kind of person, you know, I cannot imagine being a day late on filing my taxes, much less 17, 18 years. And the funny thing is, I've had clients who filed a tax return a day or 2 days late, and they get these penalty letters from the IRS. The IRS is all over them. And he said, I've never heard a thing. I mean, the IRS has never even talked to the guy. And so it's really interesting. The IRS system is really based on the compliant. What they do is they audit, they track, and they harass those people who file returns. They have no methodology at all for dealing with people who never file a return. But that's the world we live in. It reminds me of the person who said, you know, if you thought taxation without representation was bad, you should see how bad it is with representation. One very common thing to do is simply to transfer assets into the name of the spouse. And we do that oftentimes just to equalize assets, and I'll show you how we do that. Again, there is a homestead allowance in Utah. Very, very small. only $40,000, there is some. And then there is also exemptions for personal property. You're able to retain certain kinds of personal property. It was funny, I was going through looking at the list yesterday. You can protect clothing except for furs or jewelry. You've got to turn your furs in. You can have one set of bedding for each person in your family. I thought that was nice. And you can have a sewing machine. The other one I liked is it said that you can keep works of art as long as a picture of you is in the artwork. So if you buy the Mona Lisa, make sure you sketch in yourself in the background somewhere, and then you can keep it and have it protected from creditor claims. But if you're not in the picture, they can come and take it from you. Certain things are not dischargeable. Yeah. Yeah, the statute's a little unclear. I actually read it yesterday looking at it. What it says is if there is an annuity that is used to provide for the expenses and needs of a beneficiary of the annuity and their dependents, it's protected. I read that to say that it's been annuitized. I don't know that that necessarily is the case. I'd probably feel better if it was annuitized, but I don't know that under the statute you'd actually have to have done that. Exactly, and that the nice thing is, yeah, and that's a good point because I think you can make a very good faith argument that, hey, even if I haven't annuitized this, this has a number of current benefits, whether it's disability benefits or other benefits built into the policy that have inherent protection. Again, another way of doing that is to simply put the annuity in the name of the spouse, is another way of creating asset protection. One of the things I like to do when I look at spouses is to see who the higher risk spouse is. I've had this rash of husband and wives coming in who are both doctors, and that makes it a lot more difficult. And then we look to see, well, what kind of doctor are you? So it's not a foolproof method, but oftentimes what I'll do is I'll have husband own protected assets, 401ks, life insurance, IRAs. I have spouse own house, brokerage accounts, those kind of things. Very simple asset protection, but very effective. Yes?
I have a question. But on the bankruptcy code, if you were to transfer that annuity to the wife within 1 year, then they could probably undo that.
Yeah, good question. If they can show it was intended to delay, hinder, or defraud creditors, oftentimes I do asset protection planning in coordination with estate planning. And one of the things I like to do is to equalize estates and to say, look, I want to make sure it's protected so no matter what spouse dies first, I've got assets in their name for step-up purposes to make sure I maximize the use of the credit. So there are reasons I can show that I did something other than purely creditor related. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, good question. One of the things I like to do in Utah is to use separate trusts. One, to clearly identify which spouse is the creator of that trust and to clearly identify how they're titled. You can have a joint trust. Most joint trusts still identify which assets are the husbands and which are the wives. But I just as a practice, I like to use separate trusts to more clearly delineate those distinctions. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, good question. I'll keep going. I'm going to keep going down the road to explain. Yeah, no, good question. Certain assets aren't protected or not dischargeable in bankruptcy. I mentioned the taxes earlier. Debts are for personal injury or death caused by driving while intoxicated are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. And then student loans, unless it would be an undue hardship to repay. I always wonder what a due hardship is, but it has to be an undue hardship. So certain things you still can't protect from. So back to our guy, again, there's certain statutory protections. I can protect up to $40,000 of the house. The IRA, the 401k, life insurance are protected. Checking and savings, I can keep certain minimum amounts of cash. So there is already some protection. So what's our first line of defense? Well, to me, insurance is always our first line of defense, making sure that we have good homeowner, auto, malpractice, or D&O insurance, and then making sure we have a good umbrella policy. It's shocking to me how inexpensive umbrella policy coverage is, and yet how few people have anything other than just the bare minimum. I had a client just the other day, they quoted to go from $2 million to $5 million. It was like another $300 a year or something like that. Again, they were in a high-risk profession, and the risk doesn't necessarily just have to come from the profession. And so insurance is great. And the one thing I really like about insurance is that the insurance company has the duty to defend. They have to hire the lawyer to defend you. It doesn't mean when you're sued that it's a legitimate case, but it doesn't mean it's not going to cost you money to hire a lawyer to defend you. I'd much rather have the insurance company be the one writing those checks than me. Okay, so again, one of the common things that we do is just look at the titling of the assets and try to equalize the assets. Good for both asset protection planning and estate planning. The other thing I like to do is I like to pretend to be generous with my kids by giving them the cars that they drive, giving them the boats, those kind of things, so that I don't own them. I had a client who had a 20-year-old daughter who was driving, and she was actually driving a company car. They had bought a car inside the company to be able to deduct it. She was driving in the winter, hit a patch of black ice, and hit a pedestrian. The pedestrian became a quadriplegic. And not only were they subject to risk, but now the company is subject to risk too, because it was an asset of the company too. And again, I'm a big fan of insurance because in those circumstances, you want and need money to help provide for that person. But you also want to make sure that you don't extend that risk. There's a Utah statute, for those of you who own boats, by the way, that says that the owner of a boat is liable for the negligent use by a minor. You let your 17-year-old drive your boat around, and they cause some kind of injury, you're the one who's on the hook for that. So be very careful when you let minors drive your boats. I had one of my partners, he liked to give the boats to the kids and then borrow the boats from the kids so that he didn't own it. So if and when they had some kind of issue, he wasn't the one liable for it. So I like to just give those things away. So just by doing that, again, we can do some additional planning. We give the boat away to a child or adult child. We move the house into mom's name, and we set up her estate planning so that not only is it inherited back, but it's inherited back inside a trust, which is now protected for the benefit of the client. And it allows for a full step up in basis as opposed to only a half a step up in basis. So with some very, very basic estate planning for mom, I can now get a full step up in basis and completely protect that asset for the benefit of Dr. Jones. Yes?
I'm giving assets to kids. Do you only suggest that if they're minor
kids? There is actually a Utah statute which protects, it's basically the opposite of the boat statute. It says that if you have a minor child who's driving a vehicle of yours, that your liability is limited. It's like $2,500. There's a Utah statute. What's interesting, though, is, well, what happens if they're 18 and they're driving my car? So I actually like to give the cars to the kids on their 18th birthday. Again, I can pretend like I'm being generous. What I'm really trying to do is I don't want to have a situation where the child gets in an accident and they come and sue me and claim that I should not have let them drive my vehicle because I knew that they were a bad driver. Well, they're 18, of course I knew they were a bad driver. It's presumptive. I found more curbs than I ever knew existed in my neighborhood. I've been letting my 15-year-old practice driving, and it's like a pinball. We just go back and forth hitting the curbs. I think it's $2,500. I'd have to look at it. But there is no, it doesn't mention anything about adult children. So again, that's when I would transfer it, is when they're adults. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and usually you need to check with the insurance company on that, but I think you can still get coverage on that even if it's in the child's name. Yeah, I'm seeing some nods. Good. Okay, so let's talk about trust. One thing that Brandon asked earlier, and one thing I like to do is to set up separate revocable living trusts and to move the residents, for example, from the higher risk spouse to the lower risk spouse trust. Again, the higher risk spouse may still own the 401ks, the life insurance, those kind of things, but I have the lower risk spouse own things that are harder to protect, like a personal residence. If I'm worried about both spouses, one thing that we can do is set up a Q-tip trust or what's called a spousal access trust. It's an irrevocable trust that I set up for the benefit of spouse, and then that way it's not subject to the creditor claims of either myself or my spouse. I'll typically do that only if both spouses could have issues, because those tend to be a little harder to refinance. If you want to go get a HELOC or you want to get a refinance your mortgage or something, it's in the trust. A lot of banks don't understand that. They want you to pull it out of the trust. So I will use these when I either have a paid off house or if I have a concern that I want to add protection in case either spouse has a creditor issue or concern. Another common, very simple asset protection tool is to use limited liability companies. If I own $100,000 of stock, that's worth about $100,000, and it's fairly easy for a creditor to come and take that. But if I place that into an LLC and I take back a membership interest, now I no longer own the asset, I own an interest in that LLC. And basically what I've done is I've traded ownership of assets for a certain list of rights. What's interesting is under Utah law, if I then have a creditor is only entitled to a very few number of those rights. Most of those rights don't transfer to the creditor. For example, if a creditor were to come and say, stick them up and give me all your assets, I say, well, I've got an interest in this LLC. But if you try to take it, you have no right to vote. You have no right to require distributions. You can't terminate the LLC. The only thing you're entitled to are distributions that the LLC would otherwise make to me. And by the way, that's up to my wife on whether any distributions are made. So it goes from being a very attractive asset to a very unattractive asset. Yes?
The question, Matt, because I have a situation. So if in bankruptcy, they sometimes think of, see a single LLC as just a ever seen them take the assets from a single member LLC require basically a distribution in that situation? So you would, what about in the husband and wife? Will they do it against, will they consider both of them as a single member?
Yeah, good question. I actually got it right here.
Oh, okay.
So think of asset protection when it comes to LLCs in two contexts. The first is what I call bottom-up asset protection, and that is I own an asset inside an LLC, a rental property, and let's say somebody slips and falls or the roof caves in or there's some liability and they want to sue the owner. Well, they're suing the LLC. They're limited to the assets of the LLC, and so it compartmentalizes that asset and that risk from the other assets that I have. But what if someone sues me and wants to get into the LLC? Well, under Utah law, if it's a single member LLC, if I'm the only one that owns it, then creditors can come in and scoop out all of those assets. Think of it like a bowl. That asset protection is great bottom up, but if somebody comes to me, they can scoop all those assets out and take them. But under Utah law, if an LLC has two or more members, then it becomes more like a shell, and a creditor is not allowed to get inside that LLC. It's really to protect the other members, but it does limit them so that the only thing they can ever get to are any distributions that the LLC were to make. Nevada actually just changed their law last year to allow charging order limitations on single member LLCs. So they actually went against that, and they said even if you are a single member LLC, you can't, a creditor can't get into there. Yeah, you know, it's one of those that I think 50%, 50-50 is the ideal. You know, 60-40 is better than 99-1. 70-30 is better than that. I like it to be meaningful, and I like it to be real. One of the things that's nice is that I can do an LLC with a husband and wife, have them be 50-50. That's a multi-member under state law, and yet I can have it ignored for income tax purposes, so I don't have to file a separate tax return. Husband and wives who file joint can have a disregarded LLC. Yes? Typically only if the assets are also out of state. I had a client who their planner set up a bunch of Alaska LLCs to own Utah real estate. The problem is that's doing business in the state of Utah. The Alaska LLC then has to file, register to do business in Utah. When it does that, it's now subjected itself to Utah jurisdiction, so you're not getting any benefit. But if you actually have an asset in that state, or you have an asset that's easy to move, that's an extra layer, because even if I get a judgment in Utah, I then have to take it to that other state. Exactly. Yeah, for other assets, brokerage accounts, bank accounts, those kind of things. Nowadays, it's very easy to set up and maintain accounts in different jurisdictions. Yeah, good question. Okay. If I'm a creditor of a member of an LLC, I'm limited to what's called a charging order. And a charging order basically says, hey, if you're going to give any money to the debtor, give it to me instead. But that's basically the only right that they have. They can attempt to foreclose on that, but that actually makes it worse for the creditor, because if I try to foreclose, I still have no right to vote, no right to require distributions, but now I'm taxed on the percentage earnings of that entity, even though I don't get any money. All I get is a K-1, and now you're in an actually worse position than you were before. And I could get taxed on money that I'm not actually even receiving. So most creditors are gun-shy from doing something like that. So another common asset protection tool, again, I mentioned earlier, is to compartmentalize risk from assets. I see a lot of clients who they have their business operations, their property that they operate on, their equipment, all those kind of things in a single LL or a single corporation or single LLC. One of the things I oftentimes like to do is to compartmentalize that by creating separate entities for each entity. And so I have the real estate in one, equipment in another, operating business in a third. So if in my operating business, somebody drives down to the local office depot to pick up supplies and they involved in an auto accident and they want to sue the company because the 18-year-old runner was acting as an agent for my company, they can sue the company, but they can't get to the assets or to the equipment. I've compartmentalized that away. There's also some income tax benefits to that by potentially converting ordinary income, active income in the business, to passive income in the form of rent payments on the equipment and on the real estate. And so there's some asset protection and estate planning, or asset protection and income tax benefits to doing that. I have a lot of clients who own multiple pieces of rental property. One of the things we can do is put those rental properties inside an LLC, so it limits the liability or exposure of those rentals from the client. But I can even take it a step farther and put separate rentals in each LLC and then have a master holding. Each of these subsidiaries are single member LLCs, so they're disregarded for income tax purposes, but the holding company I have is a multi-member LLC, so if either of the members were sued, I've got the top-down asset protection, I've got the bottom-up asset protection, but now I've added, because now if something happens at rental property one, it's not subject to rental properties 2, 3, and 4 aren't subject to those potential risks. Yes?
Is that basically a series LLC?
You can use a series LLC, or you can use separate single member LLCs, either one.
Is that one tax return right there?
Just one tax return. Yeah. To me, it all comes down to what the clients are willing to do. In order for this to really work, you need to have separate bank accounts for each one. You need to have separate lease agreements, and you need to really operate them like they're separate LLCs. Some clients say, hey, that's no problem. I set up QuickBooks. I can manage different accounts all the time. Other clients say, I can't handle that. I'd rather have some asset protection than none. And sometimes it's a good, better, best. You know, this might be the best, but I'll settle for good if this is what they can actually implement from a practical standpoint. Yeah. Yeah, like a leasing company. Yeah, I have set up some leasing companies where you're actually leasing the employees over. You can actually compartmentalize risk a little bit more even there, especially with respect to any HR issues that could come into play. So if you had a lot of employees, if you had potential HR issues, there's another way of compartmentalizing that.
Did you put that in an LLC?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, again, it kind of depends. In Utah, it's so cheap to set up an LLC, and it's so cheap to maintain them. I don't know that series LLCs work necessarily quite as effectively as in other states where you might be able to, but even in other states, you still have to separately register. I haven't found that series LLCs save me that much time and effort. That's just my personal. You know, you go to two lawyers, you get three opinions and four bills. So this is just kind of my take on it. All right. Oh, go ahead.
Well, then you have a rental property by the sea in California. The rules are totally different.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Dealing in the People's Republic of California is never easy. Okay. So now let's look at our doctor. So now what we've done is we've taken the house, put it in his wife's trust. We put the cabin into an LLC with he and his wife. So again, if something happens at the cabin, I've compartmentalized that risk. And it's a multi-member LLC. We moved the cars to the spouse. We gave the kids the boat. The IRAs, 401ks, life insurance are all protected. We gave the house to the mom. We put the in brokerage accounts into, a multi-member LLC. And we keep any excess cash in there. We only keep enough cash to get by for 6 months or so. And then we put the LLC or the rental properties either into an LLC or into a couple different LLCs. Again, that's not a ton of extra work. It's really just moving some things around. But we've really dramatically changed the asset protection structure for this client and added quite a bit of protection and not a lot of extra. So what can we do beyond that? The trusts have been used for literally hundreds of years for asset protection. The general rule has always been I can set up a trust for the benefit of anyone in the world and have it completely asset protected from the claims of their creditors except for myself. So I can set up a trust for anybody else. It's basically bulletproof asset protection, but I can't do that for myself. Trusts have also historically been limited in how long they can last. It's called the rule against perpetuities. It goes back to the Duke of Norfolk's case in 1682, which is a fascinating case I could bore you with if you'd like. I actually really like the case. So those have been the two biggest limitations. Well, in 1997, Alaska became the first state to set up what are called self-settled trusts. They basically they took what was done in offshore jurisdictions and they applied it here domestically, and they attacked those two things. First of all, they said, if you set up a trust, and as long as when you set up the trust, it's not a fraudulent conveyance at the time that you set it up, then those assets are not subject to the claims of your creditors, even if you're a beneficiary. So it allows me to have my cake and eat it too. What's really interesting is the general rule on what's subject to estate tax is whether an asset is subject to the claims of my creditors. In other words, if my creditors can get to my assets, then it's in my estate and subject to estate tax. If creditors can't, then it's not subject to estate tax. And so oftentimes when I set up an Alaska trust for estate planning, I get asset protection benefits. And when I set it up for asset protection, I get estate planning benefits. And so it allows you to actually get some multiple benefits. Yes? The Alaska statute. Yeah, good question. Other states have followed suit. There's a list, and it's growing every year. Each state, again, is very different. Forbes is interesting. The last couple of years, they've come out with a grading scale, and they've ranked each state that has a statute and given them a grade. Nevada, Alaska, South Dakota, those are kind of what are referred to as the top tier, probably the three best jurisdictions to set up self-settled trusts. Utah actually has set up a self-settled trust statute a couple of years ago, but they only get a C grade. We only get a C, which is average, I guess, because there's a number of exception creditors, which not only affect the asset protection, but affect the estate planning benefits. I could get into that if you want, but really the top three states for setting up domestic asset protection trusts now are Nevada, Alaska, and South Dakota. Obviously, they didn't sit there and say, how can we, what can we do to try to protect people from creditors in Utah? They thought, no, how can we get some business up here? It's cold. There's nothing to do. Did you see, by the way, they just got their oil check this year. It's a five-year rolling average. Each person in the state of Alaska not only does not pay state income tax, but the state pays them to live there. It's not enough, but it was like $850 this year, which is the lowest it's been. It's a five-year rolling average, and they have to drop off 2007, which was a really bad year, and then they said the money will start going up. But anyway, so what they do is they've allowed these jurisdictions, or they allow these trusts to occur in their jurisdiction because they want to get some work up there. And so you have to do some things. You have to meet some minimum statutory requirements to be an Alaska trust. But they can be a very effective estate planning tool because instead of just giving my assets away to spouse or to kids, I can actually give it away to a trust for the benefit of myself, my spouse, and my kids. And still get some, again, some additional asset protection. And I list some revenue rulings and cases. I have to share my favorite tax court case, and it's pathetic that I have a favorite tax court case. But it involves a guy who took as a charitable donation the fair market value of blood that he donated at his local hospital. He said, you know, if people give their couch to the DI and they get a tax deduction, I should be able to get a tax deduction for the blood I give. And so he argued that it was a donation of a good. I mean, it's tangible personal property. I gave it away. I should get a deduction. The IRS said, no, we don't think it's deductible because it's a service. You provided a service. And so if I give my couch to the DI, I get a deduction for it. If I go down and spend 3 hours donating my time at the DI, I don't get a deduction for that. So he argued goods, the IRS valued or argued services. And the tax court literally ruled on this case. And they came back and they said, we've determined that it's not deductible for two reasons, and we don't care whether it's a good or a service. They said, first of all, the taxpayer failed to prove his basis in the blood. In other words, he had failed to prove how much it cost him to make the blood inside his body. And then his second thing is he had failed to prove his holding period in the blood. He had failed to prove how long the blood had been in his body before he donated it, so they disallowed the deduction. So if you ever hear the IRS referred to as bloodsuckers, you know what case they're referring to. And then kind of the next stage beyond that, from domestic asset protection trusts, some people set up foreign asset protection trusts. There's a certain person running for the President of the United States who has done this and got into a little controversy over it. But it's the same theory as Alaska trusts, but as was brought up earlier, if I have my assets here in the state of Utah, a creditor here could still conceivably try to come after it. If my assets are in a foreign jurisdiction, it just makes it that much harder. Quite frankly, I find for the vast, vast, vast majority of my clients, we can just through some very simple planning add some significant asset protection without the need to do that kind of planning. All right, so with that, any questions? Yes.
On your side of things, how sad is your client's able to choose attorneys to the point
Yeah, you know, to me, part of the value of having a good plan is to try to stave off a problem beforehand. As I mentioned earlier, I'm always going to look at two things before I bring a lawsuit. One, what are my chances of prevailing? And two, even if I prevail, what are my chances of recovery? What I find is if somebody starts sniffing around, if I can show them, look, I've got a very good, strong plan here, and if you come and try to come after me, you're going to have a very, very difficult time. It might actually stave off some of those kind of things.
Isn't that the best asset protection?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, good point. Any other questions? Yes.
If you mentioned that I can set up a trust for somebody else for their benefit.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that idea. Unfortunately, the IRS has already thought of it. That's what's called a reciprocal trust. If I set up a trust for you and your family, you set up a trust for me and my family, and they have virtually identical terms and conditions, the IRS can collapse those two. And husbands and wives do these all the time. But I've actually started doing a fair number of what I call non-reciprocal trusts, where husband sets up a trust for wife and kids, wife sets up a trust maybe just for kids. I have different beneficiaries, different powers, different trustees, different assets. If I can make the two trusts different enough, the IRS can't collapse those back. And there's actually some rulings on that. And so I probably can't do it on a pure mirror basis, but if you set up those two trusts and they are different enough, it can prevent the IRS from collapsing those. Yes. Yeah, good question. Yeah, most of these trusts that are set up are grantor trusts, so they're taxed back to you. But one of the disadvantages of a foreign trust is they're subject to a ton of reporting requirements. You have to report every single thing about it, and you have to file an FBAR, which describes any assets you have in excess of $10,000 outside the United States.
So you really want to have to do that.
So, yeah, again, you can do it, and again, any good plan should survive the light of day. But they're very difficult and very cumbersome to maintain properly because the government does put a number. They don't say that you can't do it, but they want to know every single detail about what you are doing.
So it would be an advantage to do like an Alaska.
Exactly. Far fewer reporting requirements. Yeah. Yeah, last question.
Well, I was just gonna say, there are some exempted assets.
Yeah.
From
Yeah, I had a client whose father died, and he had some assets in Liechtenstein. He was actually an Australian citizen, and he had some money with UBS in Liechtenstein. It took a couple of years for us to close it down and bring the money here to the United States. Two summers ago, two special agents with the Department of Treasury, those are the guys with the badges and the guns, showed up at our door to ask a couple questions. And they were just going down a list of people who had UBS accounts in Liechtenstein. And we were able to explain to them we weren't trying to hide assets. This was actually a foreign citizen who had set this up, and that we had repatriated all those assets and that we were fully reporting it. But they were very serious, and they were looking. And Utah tends to have a disproportionate number of those for whatever reason. So, all right, thanks.